I had a hard time deciding what to talk about tonight, partially because I don't necessarily know what you're going to be interested in. I recently sat a retreat with Venerable Inalio. You may have heard of him. He's a kind of a hot monk at the moment. Maybe the word hot is not the right. But a very esteemed monk who is a really incredible scholar. He speaks 11 different languages. He's originally from Germany. Spent a long time in Sri Lanka studying the texts. And he learned, I think he taught himself Chinese so he could translate the ancient agamas, which are similar to the Pali Canon, the ancient Buddhist suttas, discourses. There are different, you know, versions that went to different countries in, you know, 2,000 plus years ago. I don't know how much detail to go into about these types of things, so I'm going to try to keep it fairly straightforward. But I was just inspired in general by Venerable Inalio's deep dedication to mindfulness practice, Dharma, and also to understanding what he really is studying early Buddhism, and he's trying to kind of bring forward early Buddhism in a new way. And then but he also practices constantly himself, so he's a very dedicated just practitioner of meditation, and there's a couple unique things about him. One is he sleeps in a coffin. So he really takes death contemplation to another level. And he also meditates with a life-size, it's not a real human skeleton, but a life-size, you know, model of a human skeleton. As another way to just keep, he really believes that death contemplation is important for our practice to keep. That's part of his motivation, keeps his priorities straight, I guess. And I just found that inspiring, and when I sat retreat, it made me sort of look at my own practice. Been practicing for quite a while. It's kind of like, what can I do to sort of sharpen things up here? And what was interesting is he's also very practical. One of the first things he started talking about was posture. What's your meditation posture? And he said, you really need to get your knees, if you're sitting on a cushion, your knees need to be on the, you know, flat, basically. There's something called Burmese style, that where your knees are flat. And but I'm a tall, you know, tight guy who needs to do more yoga. And the only way I can get my knees all the way down flat is to sit way up, kind of high on a bunch of cushions, which seemed sort of ridiculous to me. But I checked in with him during this retreat, and he said, yeah, that's what you have to do. But what encouraged me was he had done the same thing. He didn't start. Right now, he sits flat. He doesn't even have a cushion under him. He just sit, because that's what he believes is how the Buddha would have sat, early Buddhists would have sat. And he's really trying to live kind of like an early Buddhist in certain ways. So I found that inspiring, that at least he didn't start right there. And so I kind of pushed myself to sit up high with my knees all the way down. And I still couldn't get this left knee to stay down to save my life. But it did feel like a better posture for my knees. In other words, the truth is my old posture, I could sit for a long time, but when I went to stand up, my left knee in particular would be in a lot of pain. So I kind of knew things were off, and I thought I should try what he's suggesting. And I'm not talking about extreme pain where I'm, you know, but a little bit of pain. It felt like probably I shouldn't keep sitting like this too much longer. So anyway, I did start sitting this way, and it was interesting because it was painful because my body was sort of learning to a new posture and to stretch in certain ways it wasn't used to. So I couldn't sit for as long as I'm used to, and meanwhile, Venerable Inalio was sitting for 4 hours at a time in the front of the room, and we would do sitting, walking, and different things. And he'd just be sitting there still the whole time. We'd come in and out of the room, have breaks, whatever. He can just keep sitting. So there was that example. And being from the competitive part of the world, part of me wanted to try to hang in there, but I just had to throw that out the window. But one thing that happens, and this one quote inspired the whole talk tonight. I guess I'll start with it. I happened to see during the retreat, I won't explain why I saw this quote, but I happened to see this quote from Muhammad Ali. And it was, I verified, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't spreading false quotes from people, but apparently Muhammad Ali did really say this. He said, the full quote is, I'll start with the quote I heard or saw. It said, "Don't quit, suffer now, and live the rest of your life as a champion." Okay, and I thought that was a pretty awesome quote. And then I found his full quote was, "I hated every minute of training, but I said, don't quit, suffer now, and live the rest of your life as a champion." Well, Muhammad Ali was one of my great heroes as a kid, because he just was a bigger than life figure. And that quote brings us to our topic, which is right effort. And the mental factor in Pali is virya, which is usually translated as energy, but it can also mean, it's not just, the context for it is more like perseverance, and can even mean courage, strength, depending on the context. So there are some nuances. There's not like one perfect English word for virya, the Pali word. So I think that Muhammad Ali's quote is one aspect of virya, not the whole thing. But that quote just kept me going, even when it would be painful to the way I was sitting. And then I did find that over time, my legs got used to being kind of folded in a particular way, and now I'm sort of enjoying that posture more and more. I'm still sitting up pretty high. So this is, you know, one aspect, perhaps, of right effort, that we, to push ourselves a little in our practice, not to just kind of do the same thing every day, but keep the practice alive and see what we could, if there's anything skillful that we could do to improve our practice. And this is a lifelong, it's really an art form, you know, that we're cultivating here. So there's always some ways we can kind of, or maybe your practice is just right on and that's great. More power to you. The Buddha, I got this from Joseph Goldstein, but the Buddha said virya makes it possible for us to achieve our aspirations. And Diane mentioned that I did have lunch, really brunch with Vance Pryor yesterday, who I know taught here recently. And he said, I told him I was going to be here tonight. And he said, oh, what topic are you going to talk about? And I said, right effort, wondering. And he said, oh, well, what else is there, really? And I thought that was great. So, what else is there? This is what we're bringing to the practice in a way, you know, our energy. And of course, this is all in the service of mindfulness. I feel like I should say we're bringing our energy to mindfulness meditation, mindfulness practice, and the whole path, the Noble Eightfold Path. So right effort is a part of the Noble Eightfold Path. I'm assuming most of you know what that would be, but should I go through the Noble Eightfold Path for... let me just say that there are three baskets of the Noble Eightfold Path. One is sort of the morality part, where we kind of get our conduct in line with wholesomeness and kind of weeding out the unwholesome actions, speech, and the livelihood, if we're doing something that's maybe harming other beings or the environment or something, we might look at our livelihood. And we find that as we kind of clear up the sila, that's Pali word would be sila, S-I-L-A, as we clear that up, the mind actually naturally starts calming down because we're not, there's less agitation even if we're not meditating yet. And also we could be cultivating generosity and compassion, things like this as well. And then usually the next basket would be the concentration, the real meditation practice. This is not the order of the Noble Eightfold Path, but the second basket, the way it's usually described, is the concentration, which or samadhi basket, which includes right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And they will all kind of go together, work together. And they allow us to really see things clearly. And then we get to the third basket, which is the wisdom part, where we start to have insights into the true nature of reality, if you want to put it that way. And also we start to have what's called right view and right intention. Usually when the Noble Eightfold Path is listed, they start with right view, because everything kind of has to start, it sort of starts and ends with right view. So it's not exactly a step-by-step thing. I wasn't planning to go through the whole Noble Eightfold Path, but I thought I should just make sure everybody's somewhat on the same page here. So, but first we have to get on the path, right? And what occurred to me, and I found quotes to back this up, that we need a sense of spiritual urgency that gets us on this path. And the Buddha obviously must have had some sense of a spiritual urgency to do what he did, which was kind of leave his family and go off and become an ascetic and try a lot of different practices. And there is a poem, it's a discourse, but it's sort of in a poem, poetic form, from the Book of Eights, which is the scholars, according to one of my teachers, Gil Fronsdale, scholars believe this is perhaps the earliest text known. Like, in other words, it might have been the closest thing to what the Buddha would have actually said, from the Book of Eights. And this is called the Atadanda Sutta, the Discourse on Being Violent. And I think when I read this, I feel like this is part of what gave the Buddha some spiritual urgency for his practice. And I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's 2 pages long, but I want to give you a sense of it. It starts out, violence gives birth to fear. Violence gives birth to fear. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken. Seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water and seeing them feuding with each other, I became afraid. The world is completely without a core. Everywhere things are changing. Wanting a place of my own, I saw nothing not already taken. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. Then I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. When the arrow is pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. So I'll stop there for now. But I feel like that is, there's a sense of spiritual urgency in that to me, that he's sort of looking around at the world and just wondering, what is this all about? All these people are being violent towards each other. And, there's a lot of fear and quarrels, and there's nothing to hold on to, really. So he went searching. And, I think that it might be interesting just to ask ourselves, what brings us to this practice periodically, and just to check in. And as was said, I'm in recovery. So I found out when I was 21 that I was an alcoholic through a series of unfortunate incidences, you might say. And so that kind of put me on a spiritual path that I wasn't necessarily planning for myself. Because I did realize, you know, I was able to see that there was a family history of alcoholism, and that my drinking pattern was pretty clearly alcoholic, and that I would be much better off if I stopped drinking. So, but then what do you, you know, I didn't know what, all of my friends were kind of from the, you know, there was a certain social part of drinking that was a big part of my lifestyle, honestly, and I didn't know what to do with myself without that, because I really had to leave all my old friends and find new friends. So that was part of the spiritual path. Is, and the Buddha talks about, you know, if you can't find wise friends, you're actually better off alone, which is a sad but interesting statement. So anyway, I found myself on this spiritual path, and I followed it to the best of my ability. And at some point, somebody took me to hear Jack Kornfield speak, and that was 1993. And I just really enjoyed his Dharma talks, and he was just very entertaining, told very moving stories that touched my heart. They did this period of sitting for about 35 or 40 minutes before the talk. I suffered through that to hear the talk. And I went for quite a while. And I mean, the idea of meditation appealed to me. I wanted to meditate, but it was really hard. And I just always remember I would sit in the back row at Spirit Rock in the old trailer buildings, and Jack would be this, like, way up in front. And I'd just be sitting there, and people seemed to be being very quiet, and I would just be like really antsy in the back of the room. And I did that for a long time. And, you know, I was trying to practice some at home, but it wasn't until I ended up, another different type of series of unfortunate incidences happened, where I got laid off from a really big job I had. And I also ended up going through a divorce, and I went through a move. And I ended up, I had been in Seattle for a while, and ended up back in the Bay Area, came back to Spirit Rock somewhat feeling defeated, I guess, because I was going through a lot of tough stuff. And at some point, it dawned on me that they kept talking about these things called retreats. Well, that whole previous time, it really never caught my attention. I just liked the stories Jack was telling, and I don't know what I was doing. but you know, I was in a certain level of pain, or, you know, the spiritual urgency was actually there now, and I was ready to do what needed to be done, you know. And so I went on my first retreat. It was a 5-day men's retreat at Spirit Rock, and it was pretty life-changing, because I just felt like this is what I've been looking for, and something clicked for me, you know. And then I ended up on a 10-day retreat just a couple of weeks later. I had been on the wait list, and I got in at the last minute, and because I was between jobs, I was able to do the two back-to-back. And then I actually ended up getting a job at Spirit Rock shortly after the second retreat. So then what was nice about that was we got paid retreat time in addition to vacation time while working there. So that was handy. And I was meanwhile on fire for this practice, and so it was perfect timing to be kind of working at a center and able and a certain amount of free time or time to go on retreat regularly. So that is kind of part of my story. But Joseph Goldstein says, a feeling of spiritual urgency is the proximate cause for virya to arise, for this quality we're talking about of energy, even strength and courage. In a way, it took a certain amount of courage to go on my first retreat, because I didn't really fully know what I was getting myself into. I did a few day-longs to prepare myself, but I hadn't really meditated all day, every day, for 5 days in a row. That was nothing even close. So it was a little scary, just like not sure what I was signing up for. And I did a little research on spiritual urgency, namely it landed on the Wikipedia page. And it says, according to Tanisaro Bhikkhu, who's a monk down in San Diego, or that area, that spiritual urgency is the first emotion you're supposed to bring to the training. And one definition of it is the oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that come with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. A chastening sense of our own complacency and foolishness in having let ourselves live so blindly, and an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. So, interesting, you know. And that's why I think that the piece I read from the early discourse sort of feels like it fits pretty well with this. And then there also there's something from Buddhaghosa, who was a Buddhist scholar a century and a half ago, something like that. He said that this quality of spiritual urgency is also associated with the development of right effort. Energy has exerting as its characteristic strengthening the coexistent states as function. This is a weird, an opposition to giving way as a manifestation. Not sure I understand that myself. It has been said, he in whom this quality is present exerts himself properly. Hence energy, or the basic condition of making energy as proximate cause. I thought this made more sense than it feels like it does now. Okay, never mind. Bottom line, we need to start with this this quality to really, I think, jumpstart our practice, because we do need to put in sincere effort and have this sort of courage to show up. And I was behind a car. Oh, darn, I forgot. I took a picture of it, and now I forgot what it said. Oh, boy. Well, basically, you know, our culture is all about drive and ambition. And so when we hear strength, courage, other words, vigor, vitality, persistence, these are sort of synonyms for this virya quality we're talking about, we might get a sense that there's a real drive and ambition involved, but it's more, in my mind, it's about showing up for what's here. It's just a quality of being willing to show up consistently and to stay here in the present. And that's the key aspect of it, I think. It's not, and I have some quotes later about pushing, but it takes a lot of courage sometimes to face what's really here. And at the end of the Inalio retreat that I just sat, I didn't expect this, but he brought in climate change. And he said, you know, and this is a guy that just super brilliant human being, you know, on it doesn't matter. He's basically has a scientific mind. And he said, you know, I've been looking at the science on climate change. We have enough to, you know, we pretty much know we have about 10 years to try to turn this thing around until we reach this sort of point of no return. And if we don't start taking this seriously, we as a species are really going to be in trouble. And it was very sobering to have somebody that I have so much respect for just kind of sitting there and saying it. I wish I had exactly what he said, but he said that he thinks that mindfulness could be a key to the solution of this problem as well. And I would add that this spiritual urgency is going to have to kick in at some point. But that he believes that because mindfulness is that quality that allows us to show up and be with the difficult. I mean, I think they go together to do this. And so he was saying that he's all for the spread of mindfulness in any forms, you know, to schools, anywhere it can go, the secular mindfulness movement, which is getting pretty big these days, because it needs to, we need a collective shift in consciousness to start doing what needs to be done to turn around the potentially colossal effects of climate change. And he's talking about the acidity in the ocean and how all the fish were gonna be in peril, and you know, that's a major food chain, things like that. I'm not here to talk per se about climate change, although Diane is offering a wonderful Buddhist precepts on climate change. So if you do have your Friday afternoons free, I would encourage you to check that out. She did not pay me to say that. So let's see. I did want to give the basic here. One other thing that caught my attention around this quality, sort of moving out of spiritual urgency a little bit into another quality that jumped out at me. I was reading a biography of Ajahn Chah, who was Jack Kornfield's teacher in Thailand. He's passed away now, but seems to have been one of the really great teachers of the last century in Thailand. And this kind of jumped out at me. It wasn't even just about Ajahn Chah, who is one of my favorite teachers to hear stories about, but this, from the biography, it said, the Buddha declared that all avoidable suffering, human suffering, is caused by mental defilements, and that these defilements, like greed, hatred, and delusion, can be completely eliminated by a systematic education of body, speech, and mind. Supreme among the virtuous qualities that burn up the defilements, he revealed, the Buddha, is forbearance, which sometimes patient endurance or self-control, restraint, and tolerance. Forbearance. It is perhaps no coincidence, then, that the unwelcoming environment of Northeast Thailand nurtured a great flowering of Buddhist monasticism in the 20th century. The vast majority of monastics recognized in Thailand as enlightened masters over the past 100 years, including Ajahn Chah, have come from this region, where the people are basically known for this quality of forbearance in general, because it's they're surrounded by jungle and dense forest full of wild animals, including, you know, man-eating tigers and things. Malaria is rampant. The soil is impoverished with a lot of sand and things, and the groundwater tends to be salty. So it's a really rough place to live, but they've kind of carved out their living there through this, partially through this quality of forbearance. So this has kind of got my attention that, oh, I might want to check my forbearance meter. But it just also resonated with me that, yeah, it takes a certain level of forbearance, this practice, to keep showing up, because it's not always you know, what we want. It's not always bliss and whatnot. We have to sit through a lot of uncomfortable bodily sensations. We have a lot of, might have memories, painful memories coming up. We might have difficult emotions arise. And so we need to learn how to be with those too. That's all, as a Jon Kabat-Zinn says, in mindfulness, your welcome mat is out for everything, which I like. And then also the last words that we, you know, last words attributed to the Buddha in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta are, now monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on untiringly. or strive on with diligence, depending on your preferred translation. And somehow I've always found that we could take strive on, we need to, it's not, might not be the normal American version of striving on, but I find that similar, to me, similarly inspiring to the Muhammad Ali quote, that that's what the Buddha said last. He wanted to leave it at that. The thing about right, well, this quality of virya, it also shows up in a lot of different Buddhist lists. And so it actually shows up, it's the one quality that shows up the in the most different lists. So that also, you know, is worth noting, because it means it obviously must be pretty important. It shows up in the seven factors of awakening, which are mindfulness, investigation, then energy, rapture or joy, calm or tranquility, concentration, and equanimity or equipoise. And Venerable Inalio on this retreat I just sat was really emphasizing these seven factors of awakening, which is why my day long in May is going to be on those qualities. So I'm not going to, I don't think I'm going to talk about that too much, but they really work together, and they work, it's a, in succession with one another. They do kind of build on each other, and then you keep them, then you balance them, keep them in balance, you know, as your practice develops. And he is really, he said even when he's doing walking meditation, he's cultivating the seven factors of awakening consciously. So that, I thought that was interesting as well. I had not heard of that, sort of not heard it put that way or thought of those factors in that way. So I'll talk about that quite a lot more at the day long. I just want to, I'm going to stay on this topic for now to keep it simple. And I did want to give the sort of traditional teaching on the right effort. There's a great book that probably many of you have seen by Bhikkhu Bodhi, just called The Noble Eightfold Path. It's a great book to study, and the subtitle is Way to the End of Suffering. But it is a great book to study. I have a little bit of material from it here. He says on this, the right effort, the nature of the mental process, well, basically right effort is divided into four great endeavors. And it's funny, when I had brunch with Vance, he said, are you going to go through the four great endeavors of right effort? Because it can be a little dry sounding, but it's actually, I think it's worth hearing, because it's a key part of right effort, and it's actually very practical, something we can apply to in our daily lives. And so the first great of the four great endeavors is to prevent or guard against the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states of mind. So it's kind of like, just don't go there. And that, I mean, for me, every time I get on the computer, there's so many tempted little thoughts pop up. Oh, I could check whatever site. And I'm not going to, you know, it just could be anything, really. I mean, shopping, that's one of my, I guess one of my worst vices is book shopping online. So the first great endeavor of right effort, guarding against this arising, if it's not already there, just let it stay unarisen. The second one is to abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. So we check our mind, am I currently sort of entertaining any unwholesome mind states that I need to abandon? And then the third one is to arouse or develop wholesome states that have not yet arisen. So one that I bring in regularly in my meditation practice is gratitude, because my mind, I'm really good at noticing what's wrong in this moment. And to counterbalance that, I think thinking about what's actually right in this moment is a very powerful practice. And I was surprised, I went on a concentration retreat with Lee Brazington a couple years ago, and he His teacher was Ayakema, who was a great, sorry to throw all these names out. I don't have time to explain who everybody is, but basically Li has spent his Dharma teacher career talking about concentration practice. And he said that his teacher suggested bringing in gratitude every time you sit in meditation. And so I started doing it, and it really does help. If your mind's kind of all over the place, you bring in a little gratitude practice, and it does often help kind of settle the mind. But check it out for yourself. That is, if you don't have aversion to gratitude practice, which I have gone, I've been there too. But I teach in prison a lot, and I love talking about bringing gratitude practice in prison, because certainly in prison there are plenty of things that people could be complaining about, it's also great to remind them that there are actually things you can be grateful for even if you're in prison. And it's also interesting to hear what they might find that they do feel grateful for in that moment. So there is developing the wholesome states. And then the fourth great endeavor is to maintain or sustain any wholesome states that have already arisen, and to kind of keep cultivating them and perfect them if possible. So once they've arisen, try to keep fuel the good states and let go of the unwholesome ones. And this can sound a little abstract, but it's very practical and real in our in my daily life. I see it all the time. I recently noticed, for a number of reasons, that my coffee habit was not feeling wholesome anymore. Like I love the taste of coffee. I enjoy many things about coffee, but I just was noticing that it wasn't adding anything wholesome to my quality of life. And this is not coming down hard on coffee in general, but I'll probably end up going back to coffee at some point, I don't know. But it's been interesting to work with, because, and I should say I still drink tea, so I'm not completely caffeine free, but coffee is about 4 or 5 times stronger than tea apparently, and I do feel it just sort of works better for me right now. But it's interesting, because I have a favorite bakery in my neighborhood, and I used to get a cup of coffee there every time with the bakery items. And so now I'm going in the bakery, and I have the habit in my mind of getting the coffee with the baked goods. So I'm really working with this exact thing, because the thought is going to be the unarisen, unwholesome state of wanting coffee pops in as soon as I walk in the door and I see the little cups. Something about the cups, because I've held those cups a bunch of times. And then abandoning the unwholesome state. I mean, this is just an example. I'm not really down on coffee, but it's just been interesting to work with. That's just one example, but so I would just suggest that you find things in your daily life that you can practice with these things on, because then it might be easier when you're in your meditation. Well, first of all, my meditation practice helps me in those moments a lot. I think that gives me a base where I have the much more freedom of choice to say no coffee today. Whereas sometimes I do have a young daughter at home, and if I don't get a good night's sleep and I'm getting stressed and my wife's upset with me about something, I might just have that coffee anyway. I could see how that, I did do that recently, and then I had a headache the next day when I wasn't drinking the coffee. Anyway, so one of the things that Anolio talks about, and I guess this is not a new teaching, but it was something I had noticed, that the 7 factors of awakening and the 5 hindrances are really 2 sides of the same coin, if that makes sense. And I definitely will talk about that more on that the day long. I'm trying to force you to come to my day-long. Part of right effort is working with the five hindrances. They are, you may know them, the sensual desire, ill will or aversion, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, and doubt. And these are kind of the unwholesome states that we're talking about in the, that's one way to characterize a lot of them. And so, let's see, the right effort is, it's about overcoming these states. And Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about this. I'm just trying to figure out what quote I was going to read. They receive the name hindrances because they block the path to liberation. They grow up and over the mind, preventing calm and insight, the primary instruments for progress. The first two hindrances, sensual desire and ill will, are the strongest of the set, the most formidable barriers to meditative growth, representing respectively the unwholesome roots of greed and aversion. The other three hindrances, less toxic but still obstructive, are offshoots of delusion, usually in association with other defilements. So those are just kind of reminders. A lot of us probably have heard this material before, but just this is the what we need to be aware of as we're looking at these in our practice to bring the right effort in. And right effort is a direct counterbalance in particular to the sloth and torpor, the lack of energy. So we're bringing in more energy. And there was a Joseph Goldstein says an interesting thing, that the function of sloth and torpor is to retreat from difficulties. The function of sloth and torpor is to retreat from the difficult stuff that comes up. So it's more than we want to deal with, so we get kind of sleepy all of a sudden. And suddenly I can't really be bothered to stay mindful and aware, and I'd rather just go lie down, or, you know, we just kind of go to sleep in different ways. And so this is just something to look at and be aware of. So that gives you some idea of the sort of traditional view of working with right effort and the four great endeavors. And we have a few minutes left. I wanted to get to a few other things. The Dhammapada has found quite a few quotes around effort in the Dhammapada. So it really was emphasized throughout the Buddhist literature. Better than 100 years lived lazily and lacking in effort is one day lived with vigor and exertion. Better than 100 years lived without seeing the arising and passing of things is one day lived seeing their arising and passing. That's one famous passage from the Dhammapada. Another one, through effort, vigilance, restraint, and self-control, the wise person can become an island no flood will overwhelm. And the last one, with steady effort, one should do what is to be done, because the lax practitioner stirs up even more dust. I like that one. And Bhikkhu Bodhi said one other thing about this factor, the virya, the energy. This mental factor that's behind right effort can appear in either wholesome or unwholesome forms. The same factor fuels desire, aggression, violence, and ambition on the one hand, and generosity, self-discipline, kindness, concentration, and understanding on the other. So the exertion, the exertion involved in right effort is a wholesome form of energy, but it's something more specific, namely the energy in wholesome states of consciousness directed to liberation from suffering. kind of a heavy. Hopefully you followed that. I could read it again. It's a wholesome form of energy, but it's something more specific, namely the energy in wholesome states of consciousness directed to liberation from suffering. Okay. I know I tend to use too many notes, probably. But there's just so much. It was interesting because I had a hard time deciding what to talk about tonight, and then I chose this topic and then realized there was this overwhelming number of things I could say about it. So then you have to choose. I wanted to bring in something that I've found really important because, first of all, I think there is a time for striving and practice. In other words, that we do sometimes have to push ourselves a little because we have to be careful about, you know, looking at our habits. We may come into our practice with some habits that tend towards the sloth and torpor a little bit. I mean, that's one of my issues. So that I have found that it's been useful for me to push myself a little and say, sit for longer periods of time than, or, you know, stay up later on a retreat. And just keep practicing, even when it'd be nice to maybe just go home and go back to my room and go to sleep, but to push myself a little. And sometimes practicing around other people helps inspire us to push ourselves. And the trick is, the image used is of a lute, tuning a lute. We don't want to be too tight, but the strings to be too tight or too loose. But, you know, when you're tuning an instrument, sometimes you kind of have to go too tight and then come back and, you know, you go too tight, too loose. You got to find the balance there. So maybe we do, just don't forget to sometimes push it a little just to see. I know that has helped me at different times, the competitive sitting. I'm not encouraging competitive sitting, but I think you know what I mean. And there are different, so Ajahn Amaro, another teacher I like, he talks about the middle way. He says, I focus on the middle way a lot because I feel it's such an important principle. It doesn't mean just being excited or stoked up half the time and exhausted or semi-conscious the other half. It is not leaning into the next thing half the time and then dozing the other half. It's a different quality altogether. The middle way is the point on which the two extremes pivot. It is where they meet. So similar to the tuning the instrument. This means that in meditation, you begin to find a way of steering the mind. There's an inclining towards concentration. There's an inclining towards insight, but you're not pushing. So it's a little bit of, I like this inclining rather than pushing. The middle way is finding that quality of being still, that awareness which is perfectly still, not tied up with movement and time, yet which receives the qualities of change and movement. When we are able to be really aware of that becoming habit, we notice it almost like the feeling of gravity on the body or the texture of our clothes on our skin. And when we can see that, feel it, know it, we can begin to let go of it. So hopefully that gives, as our practice develops, we start to learn, this is part of the art of it all. And this is how we learn to, you might have to push a little to find the edge, and then you learn how to back off, and then just incline yourself in these wholesome directions and towards the concentration, but you're not pushing for concentration because that will actually kind of keep it away in a certain sense. And then Ajahn Amaro talked about a couple interesting phrases that I just wanted to mention. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's a teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, who has a phrase that he calls undistracted non-meditation. I don't mean to confuse you, but undistracted non-meditation. So he says, practice undistracted non-meditation. But that kind of can give a sense of, this is a very relaxed kind of efforting that we can be doing as our, especially as our practice, it's a refining of the practice when we get to that point, I think. We tend to make, Ajahn Amaro says, we tend to make meditation into a task or something that I am doing. Instead, in undistracted non-meditation, we can let go of the doingness and the thingness. That said, it's not a matter of letting the mind drift all over the place. There is an undistracted quality, a focused quality, but there is not a me doing something trying to get a result to become focused or more wise. And then he talks about a Canadian meditation teacher that he met who had a similar phrase. He called it diligent effortlessness. So there's a diligence and a keenness, but not a pushing. And these are just phrases used to point to sort of a precious, his word, precious liberating quality. But I like that. And I'm just going to end almost out of time. But so one of my favorite teachers, and I share this with, I believe, with Vance, that we talked about earlier, is Sayadaw Utejaniya from Burma. And this is one of the great things that I think that he taught me and many others of us is around this more relaxed version of effort. He says, virya is the spiritual faculty of patience and perseverance. And I understand it as persistence, not exertion or force. Please don't wear out your mind or body by striving forcefully when you meditate. Understanding can't develop when your mind or body is tired. Be cool and calm about it. Be interested. There should be consistent effort, but not exertion. Instead of using our energy to focus, we use our intelligence and wisdom by waiting and watching. And he also says, if wisdom is present, right effort is already there. He says a lot of great things. Practice in a relaxed way, but don't stop practicing. So that's kind of the key. But I just like, and he says, say you're on a retreat, if you're exhausted by the end of the day on a retreat, he says, then you're practicing wrong. Because you're doing what he's describing there. You're using too much exertion and force. And he likens it to simply the effort it takes to see or hear. Are you seeing right now? Yeah, and not everybody, a few people have their eyes closed, but and when did you become aware that you were seeing? Possibly when I mentioned it, right? And how much effort did it take to suddenly be aware that you were seeing? It's not a lot of effort, but we have to remember to put that to bring that to the forefront of the mind. And that's really mindfulness, is that just being aware that I'm seeing right now and being aware that I'm here, present in this chair, in this body, with this breath. And that's really what we're practicing for. And as we learn how to be here more and more in that way, then this quality just kind of naturally develops, and the wisdom develops with it, because we're here, we're paying attention, we know what's happening, and we can sort of see things as they really are, the definition of Vipassana, seeing things clearly. So I think that's probably a good place to end, and thank you for listening. I guess I could take questions for just if there's any, as we say in the recovery world, burning desires. any quick questions before we have to close? And if not, that's fine too. Probably pretty good. I was crystal clear. Let's see. If not, I might end on just a little more of that poem that I started with, that from the early Buddhism, just to take us out. He says, "Don't pursue what the world's knotted up in. Having fully pierced sensual pleasures or passions, train in your own full release. Truthful, not impudent or deceitful, anger-free, and never speaking divisively, a sage would overcome avarice and the evil of greed." Yeah. Well, it's. I realize I can't read the whole thing. One should. He's just describing how a sage would be in the world. Truthful, not deceitful, anger-free, not speaking divisively. A sage would overcome greed, jealousy, avarice. And it didn't turn out to be the best quote to end on. Oh, boy. Let's see. That's okay. There's also, you know, it's, as we used to say, I worked for a construction company, and the slogan was, "Perfection ain't no accident." So I'm sorry, I'll have to end it there, but I can be here for a few minutes, and if you want, we can talk about that more. I don't know how to explain it off really quickly. But thank you again for listening, and it's a pleasure to be with you, and hopefully I'll see some more of you next month.